wearing an open neck, white shirt, black suit. Sits down at the piano stool for an encore. Kirill Gerstein playing Gershwin's I Got Rhythm, reimagined by Earl Wilde, one of his seven virtuoso etudes on a theme of Gershwin. Gerstein, born in Russia, became a US citizen in 2003 and is currently professor of piano at the Stuttgart Conservatoire. Goes straight from here to the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival in the US for four concerts there. Back to the stage he comes again to take another bow. Very enthusiastic applause from the players of the BBC Symphony Orchestra. And very nicely bowing to people in the choir stalls that back of the Royal Albert Hall stage, who often get overlooked at this point in affairs. Well, welcome if you've just joined us. It's Radio 3 live at the Proms. We've reached the interval of the first of two concerts this evening. Back later on for Hervé Niquet conducting Le Concert Spirituel in Handel's Water Music and his music for the Royal Fireworks. That's in our second prom of the evening, still to come in this first one with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, Prokofiev's Sixth Symphony. But before that, during the interval, we're going to join Rana Mitter for tonight's Proms Plus literary event, recorded earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, across the road from us here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Tonight, I'll be talking to the conductor Jane Glover, who begins a series of events in which leading musicians from this year's Proms season reveal their private literary passions. Jane is director of opera at the Royal Academy of Music and music director of Chicago's Music of the Baroque. And she's also author of a book entitled Mozart's Women, which tells the story of the female family and friends of the great composer. And we're also joined by one of Britain's most celebrated actors, Simon Callow, who will be performing Jane's choice of readings. Please do welcome them both. Jane, how did you choose the authors for this event?
Oh, this is so hard. This is harder than Desert Island Discs. And I was driven largely by things I've been reading recently or things that have been important to me in the past. or throughout my reading life. And so, for instance, the first one, which is a piece of Dickens, I chose because it's his bicentenary. There's been a tremendous amount of attention on him this year, quite rightly. Some splendid books written about him, Claire Tomlin's wonderful biography, and a rather good book by Simon Callow called Charles Dickens and the Theatre of the World. But interestingly, it's led me to read the books again, and a lot of them I actually haven't looked at for literally decades. And it's been such a terrific journey to me to I read a lot when I'm on the road. Like many musicians, I'm away a lot, and I have home thoughts from abroad often and need to read a Jane Austen novel or a Dickens novel. And I started with Great Expectations this year. I've read two or three this year because actually it was the first Dickens experience I ever had. My mother read it to my siblings and myself when we were very small, and in fact it was my first experience of insomnia, yeah. Because the description of Miss Havisham, which we're not going to hear, but which is very, very famous, terrified me so much that I lay awake all night. I've chosen actually perhaps a surprising part of the book, because it's almost towards the end, the beginning of the denouement, where Pip, the hero of the book, who has become from humble origins, achieved a wonderful lifestyle through having been patronized by somebody who turns out to be somebody he didn't expect it to be, namely a criminal, is now trying to take that criminal, Magwitch, to safety of abroad, and with his great friend Herbert Pocket, takes a boat onto the Thames and sails it out into the open sea. That great Dickensian author Simon Callow was telling me earlier today how Dickens came to write this piece. So perhaps Simon could tell us about that before he reads it.
Well, Dickens was terrifically serious about his research, and he knew he wanted to write a passage about the riverbanks, and he thought he needed to do a little re-examining of it. And so, typically of Dickens, he hired a riverboat, filled it with 20 of his best friends, all his family, a small band, lashings of champagne and canapes, and entertained his guests, as he always did, and listened to their stories and laughed at them, and they arrived finally at Greenwich, and he went home and he wrote the chapter, having observed everything all through all of that conversation, because his powers of observation were absolutely photographic and precise.
And what I love about that anecdote, Simon, is that you've described something very boisterous and social and jolly. And what actually he wrote is something quiet and sinister and threatening.
This dismal time, we were evidently all possessed by the idea that we were being followed. As the tide made, it flapped heavily at irregular intervals against the shore. And whenever such a sound came, one or other of us was sure to start and look in that direction. Here and there, the set of the current had worn down the bank into a little creek, and we were all suspicious of such places and eyed them nervously. Sometimes, what was that ripple? One of us would say in a low voice, or another, is that a boat yonder? And afterwards, we would fall into a dead silence. And I would sit impatiently thinking with what an unusual amount of noise the oars worked in the tholes.
Many thanks, Simon. And Jane, I think your next choice moves us from 19th century London to 21st century Baltimore.
Well, it does, and this is a bit of a confession on my part, because until this year, I had never read a word by Anne Tyler. And she has got a new book out this year and has started giving interviews, which she apparently has not done much until now. She's written 10 or 12 novels. And I read this interview with her in The Guardian, I think, or The Observer, and was so captivated by her that I started reading her novels. And this occasionally happens to me, that you find somebody you've not read before and you instantly want to read everything they've written. And it's like finding a new friend. I remember doing the same with Margaret Atwood a few years ago and Penelope Fitzgerald a few years ago. And this year it has been my year to discover Anne Tyler. And I've never been to Baltimore. I work a lot in the States, but I've never been to Baltimore. But I now feel I have, because all her novels are set there, and she writes wonderfully about the city, all through various periods, actually, recent decades. And it's a bit like, you know, having watched every episode of The West Wing, I could now tell you everything about the White House. I know my way around it. I now know my way around Baltimore. And her stories are quite on a small scale and a little bit, not exactly parochial, but certainly contained within this Baltimore setting. And yet, like so many novelists, in that microcosm, she can create vast images and vast statements about human nature. And particularly what I love about her, I think, is that she writes with great heart. All her characters are incredibly sympathetic, not just the sort of good people, but even the sort of no good people. You warm to them as people. And, you know, there are some novelists who write with such bitterness about people, and eventually one can't bear to read another word of, I won't even say who I'm thinking of. But with Anne Tyler, you really do want to find out what happens to these people. The extract I've chosen is from a novel called A Patchwork Planet, which is narrated by a man. I always find it interesting when a female novelist gives voice to a male narrator, and vice versa, which is, I think, an interesting technical achievement. But here, the narrator is a fairly sort of no-hoper, down-and-out guy who has a rotten start in life, but actually becomes a terrific hero and a supporter of a wonderful, kind-hearted supporter of old people and people in difficulties.
Well, let's in that case hear an extract from A Patchwork Planet by Anne Tyler. Simon.
I was 19 years old, fresh out of high school, looking for a summer job before I entered college. Only nobody wanted to hire me because, let's be honest, the high school I had attended was sort of more a reform school. Not to mention that a lot of folks in the immediate area were mad at me for breaking into their houses and reading their mail. So my father asked around among his planning council members. By then, my father was head of the foundation. Eventually, he persuaded this one guy, Brandon Pearson, to put me to work in his hardware chain. But I could tell Mr. Pearson had warned his staff about my evil nature. They watched my every move, and they wouldn't let me near any money, even though money had never been my weakness. They gave me the most non-crucial assignments, and the manager nearly had a stroke once when he found me duplicating a house key for a customer. I guess he thought I might cut an extra copy for myself.
Thank you, Simon. And Jane, we now move from high emotion in Anne Tyler to what I might call high camp, E.F. Benson's Map and Lucia, another of your favourites.
I just adore those E.F. Benson Map and Lucia novels. I first met them, I think, when I was an undergraduate, so many years ago, and I sort of reread them about once every 10 years. They are some of the funniest writing I know, and I'm not one who's given a great deal for laughing out loud when I read books, but I have been known to laugh out loud on aeroplanes with tears streaming down my face at the sheer vivacity and comedy, high comedy of the writing. It's genius writing, and he has created these two immortal characters, Miss Mapp and Mrs. Lucas, Emmeline Lucas, known always as Lucia, because she has this passion for everything Italian, which she pretends to speak. And these two people in the small community, the town of Tilling, which is actually based on Rye in Sussex, vie with each other for social ascendancy. And Lucia always wins, and Miss Mapp is perpetually trying to get the better of her and never does. And there's a cast of supporting characters, all of whom are gloriously described. And all sorts of ridiculous events happen. And at the same time, it's that the writing is very satisfying. And I just love it. And I thought, particularly when I heard that Simon was going to be on the platform with us this evening, I thought, well, we better have some comedy, and that better be E.F. Benson.
But I should say that the extract you've chosen, Jane, is also one that takes a rather sly, slightly mocking view of the musical pretensions of Lucia and Mapp. And I just wondered, you know, as such a distinguished musician yourself, were you sort of having a little poke by proxy at those who perhaps take it seriously in the wrong way?
Certainly not, would I?
I don't know, would you?
But I do love the pretentiousness of I mean, the great running joke is that she claims, in the same way that she claims to speak Italian and only knows about six words, she claims to be a great pianist and actually knows one piece, which is the slow movement of the Moonlight Sonata. And I just love the pretension of it.
Well, let's hear a little bit of life in Tilling. Simon.
Miss Mapp did not yet despair of dealing Lucia some nasty blow. For the fact of the matter was, she felt sure of it, that Tilling generally was growing a little restive under Lucia's autocratic ways. She'd been taking them in hand. She'd been patronising them, which Tilling never could stand. She'd been giving them treats, just like that. She'd sent out cards for an evening party, not dinner at all, with un po' di musica written in the left-hand corner. And what an evening that po' di mu, as it was already referred to with faint little smiles, had been. It was a wet night, and in obedience to her command, for at that time Lucia was at the height of the ascendancy she had acquired at the hospital fete, they had all put mackintoshes over their evening clothes and galoshes over their evening shoes and slopped up to Mallard's through the pouring rain. A couple of journeys of Lucia's car could have brought them all in comfort and dryness, but she had not offered so obvious a convenience. Mrs. Wise's Royce was being overhauled, so they had to walk too, and the bedraggled and discontented company had assembled. They had gone into the garden room, dripped on by the wisteria, and an interminable po' di mu ensued. Lucia turned off all the lights in the room except one on the piano, so that they saw her profile against a black background, like the head on a postage stamp. And first she played the slow movement out of the Moonlight Sonata. She stopped once, just after she'd begun, because Diver coughed. And when she had finished, there was a long silence. Lucia sighed, and Georgie sighed, and everyone said, "Thank you," simultaneously. Major Benji said he was devoted to Chopin. And Lucia playfully told him that she would take his musical education in hand.
Thank you very much indeed, Simon. Now, Jane, your next reading takes us into yet another mood, and the author is Virginia Woolf.
Yes. Now, Virginia Woolf, and indeed the whole of Bloomsbury, I know is a topic and a writer that splits the reading population. Either you're passionate about it, or you find it very tiresome. And I'm passionate about it, and have been passionate about Virginia Woolf, again, for many years. I think I've certainly read all the books. I've read every letter. I've read every diary as those volumes came out in the 70s and 80s. I bought the lot and consumed them. And it's the most eloquent and at the same time improvisatory writing. You feel that she finds a little idea and goes off at a tangent with it, and it's all superbly structured and superbly coloured and textured, and the cadences are absolutely great. But the passage I've chosen is actually from one of her shorter pieces, from the collection called The Death of the Moth, which is an essay called Street Haunting. Virginia Woolf was a great walker. She walked everywhere, and particularly in London, which she adored. And this is an absolute gem of an essay about walking in London between the hours of 4 and 6 in the evening, particularly in winter when it's dark and there's so much atmosphere, and she describes all this. This section is a little bit of an in-joke between me and Virginia, because I do actually collect first editions of her, and I've got quite a big collection now, and I find them mainly in second-hand bookshops all over the world. And this extract is about second-hand bookshops. Books are everywhere, and always the same sense of adventure fills us. Second-hand books are wild books, homeless books. They've come together in vast flocks of variegated feather and have a charm which the domesticated volumes of the library lack. Besides, in this random, miscellaneous company, we may rub against some complete stranger who will, with luck, turn into the best friend we have in the world. There's always a hope as we reach down some greyish-white book from an upper shelf, directed by its air of shabbiness and desertion, of meeting here with a man who set out on horseback over 100 years ago to explore the woolen market in the Midlands and Wales, an unknown traveller who stayed at inns, drank his pint, noted pretty girls and serious customs, wrote it all down, stiffly, laboriously, for sheer love of it. The book was published at his own expense. It was infinitely prosy, busy, and matter-of-fact, and so let flow in, without his knowing it, the very scent of hollyhocks and the hay, together with such a portrait of himself as gives him forever a seat in the warm corner of the mind's inglenook. One may buy him for 18p now. He's marked 3 and 6, but the bookseller's wife, seeing how shabby the covers are and how long the book has stood there since it was bought at some sale of a gentleman's library in Suffolk, will let it go at that.
Thank you, Jane. That was wonderful. And now we turn to your final reading, which is Shakespeare, Sonnet 15, and a very poignant poem in which love and death, one might say, battle for supremacy. Why do you value this one so much?
Wherever you put the pin, really, on the list of all those sonnets, you come up with gold. But I think this one, in that whole section of ones about love and death and the passing of time, where there is a sort of melancholy and a radiance cohabiting, which you get through Shakespeare. I mean, I find this, I had to have Shakespeare in my collection, because this is somebody I return to all the time, and I thought, well, I'll have a sonnet. And I just sort of picked this one at random because I've just loved it the best, really. Well, not the best, but one of the best. How can you say it's the best?
I wonder if you might hear it, Simon.
When I consider everything that grows holds in perfection but a little moment, but this huge stage presenteth naught but shows whereon the stars in secret influence comment. When I perceive that men as plants increase, cheered and checked even by the selfsame sky, vaunt in their youthful sap, at height decrease, and wear their brave state out of memory, then the conceit of you, this inconstant stay, sets you most rich in youth before my sight, where wasteful time debateth with decay to change your day of youth to sullied night, and all in war with time for love of you, as he takes from you, I engraft you new.
Many thanks indeed to you, Simon Callow, and to my guest for tonight's Proms Plus literary event, Jane Glover.
Simon Callow read the literary passions of Jane Glover in tonight's Proms Plus literary event. The presenter was Rana Mitter, and the producer was Gavin Hurd. 20 past eight. Welcome if you've just joined us. Radio 3 live at the Proms, Hervé Niquet and Le Concert Spirituel at 10:15 this Wednesday evening. BBC Symphony Orchestra filing back onto the platform, and in just a moment they're going to perform Prokofiev's Sixth Symphony. If his Fifth Symphony, premiered in January 1945, was about raising spirits dragged down by 5 years of war, the Sixth, often austere and tragic, was perhaps designed to remember the losses that people had suffered. Something of a miracle that the work was written at all. After the premiere of the Fifth, Prokofiev had fallen down a flight of stairs after a blackout and suffered concussion. He never conducted again and found he was only able to compose at a sluggish pace. He had to get permission from his doctors to travel to Leningrad for the premiere of the Sixth. Tonight's conductor, Zachary Oramo.
Departure from Prokofiev's earliest time. It's a departure from the Fifth Symphony, which he wrote just a very short time before, actually. The Fifth Symphony is confident, it's virtuosic. It has its dark moments, but altogether it's still a kind of life-affirming piece, which this Sixth Symphony definitely isn't. I don't know whether the accident that Prokofiev had whilst actually writing this symphony had an impact. Apparently he was hit by a tram or something, and he suffered from a dizziness till the end of his life. But I feel that this Sixth Symphony has been born out of such difficulty and misery and hardship. Unlike in the Fifth, the material comes together in not an easy way at all. There are energies that actually don't belong together at all, and yet they grind against each other. They kind of create this almost unbearable tension of differences. And that's where I think that the special interest in this piece lies.
Well, alas, the work got him into trouble with Andrei Zhdanov, Stalin's musical commissar. It's curious to observe the struggle between the two Prokofievs, he wrote. Here, the melodious, harmonious Prokofiev is often attacked without provocation by the other storming Prokofiev. Just a few weeks after the premiere, Prokofiev, Shostakovich and Kachaturian were all attacked for their formalist perversions and anti-democratic tendencies, alien to the Soviet people and their aesthetic requirements. As a result, the Sixth Symphony soon dropped out of the repertoire and wasn't heard again for many years. So here is Zachary Oramo returning to the platform to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Prokofiev's Sixth Symphony.
Thank you. Thank you.